Very excited to have our second panel, which is being moderated by Mark McKinnon, who I think will introduce everyone.
Thanks very much. Well, I'm delighted to be here with such a distinguished group. This issue is so fundamental and so important. We face so many important issues right now. I mean, you look across the spectrum and there are so many challenges that people in public policy and in public office are facing right now. But this issue is remarkable to me in terms of the intensity, the emotion, the fiction, the mythology, some of which Michael addressed in the earlier panel and in the document. But I work in politics, and it's just stunning to me that I was first attracted to then Governor Bush in the mid-90s, predominantly because he was talking about compassionate conservatism and a limited role for government, but a very, very proactive, particularly on issues like immigration. I mean, he had a very immigration-friendly message, policies, and as he began to put together his campaign for the presidency, he was very, very adamant with those of us around him, advising him that he wanted to make this issue, put it on the forefront of the campaign, despite a lot of people who said that he probably shouldn't. So watching that arc politically, and then watching him in office as he tried to implement the policies, and seeing what happened from the late 90s until today is just a dramatic arc. I mean, first there was 9/11, which complicated things with the negotiations with Mexico because it became fundamentally a national security issue. But then increasingly, as the economy began to go south, it became much more of an economic issue. And then I worked with John McCain and watched John McCain's campaign, and as he was initially quite very immigrant-friendly as well in his message, and watched his campaign literally melt down over that issue early on. And that's when, as you recall, it sort of crashed and burned and his funding dried up. But that was all related to his immigration. And then I spent a lot of time on airplanes going from Washington back to Texas, and I'm always going back on Thursday nights, or I was, and would always be with the Texas congressional delegation going back, and they would get in my face about this issue all the way back and screaming at me about it, and I was really shocked. But McCain said then, and I'm sure he would say now, that he has never in his whole political career seen an issue as hot and emotional as this one. And so now we've seen the present administration grappling with it as well. So over the course of a decade, we've seen this issue evolve, morph, and yet go without any resolution at all. And just to put a sort of final point from the political viewpoint on this in terms of the arc, it's really interesting as we look back to look at what Ronald Reagan did on this issue, and to realize that if he were running today, he probably wouldn't get nominated because of this issue. So that's where we are on the political front. So and in the political arena, it's driven by, you know, fear drives a lot of politics. And that's what we're seeing on this issue. And fear usually gets stoked by a lot of mythology. And so I'm delighted to have these panelists here today who really work on the front lines of the practical application where these issues really come to bear in academia and in the labor force. Let me start with Dr. Steve Hyman. Steve is the provost of Harvard University since December of 2001 and serves as professor of neurobiology at Harvard Medical School, leading author at the intersection of molecular neuroscience, molecular biology, and psychiatry. Dr. Hyman has returned to Harvard after serving as the director of the National Institute for Mental Health from 1996 to 2001. Doctor, can you just give us a broad overview about what the real impact is of this issue on academia?
Sure. So first, just some background. The UNESCO estimates that there are 2.8 million mobile students around the world. That is, students originating in one country, getting experience in others. The main host countries are, in order, the United States, the UK, France, Germany, and then Australia. And somebody's already mentioned that we have 600,000 foreign students in the United States. The largest donor countries right now are Asian, India, China, and South Korea, and that pattern has held for a long time, although there are some, maybe we'll have a chance to talk about the growth of regional hubs in the UAE and Singapore a bit later. The 600,000 students who come to the United States are extremely variable. Post 9/11, George Borjas, a colleague at Harvard, pointed out that the way student immigration works in the United States is that individual institutions accredited somehow, sometimes seemingly magically, were able to organize student visas, and there were in 2002 there were 73,000 such organizations, ranging from Harvard, Yale, Stanford, and Berkeley to schools of beauty, and as we well know, schools of piloting, where Arabic was the most common language. Students in the United States are now tracked much more closely than prior to that time. There's a system called Student Exchange Visa Information System, or SEVIS as we know it, where there have been some technical glitches, but by and large, this year we only had a few students who we're sure were good and qualified people who didn't make it into the country. But I don't want to look at the sort of the bottom rung, but really at the top. And I'll just start, and we can have more of a discussion later, just to give you some idea of the importance of immigration for us. So one very salient example is that the greater Boston area, which includes Harvard, its affiliated hospitals, and MIT, receives $2 billion a year approximately in competitive funds from the National Institutes of Health and additional competitive funds from the National Science Foundation. If you look at the postdoctoral fellows who are in the labs with Harvard Medical School appointments, there are 1,300 such people. These are the people who aspire to become principal investigators, have their own grants, have labs, or go into industry. This is a sort of last stage apprenticeship. These are very highly skilled. And of these 1,300 in 2010, nearly 70% of them were born outside the United States. And in the last panel, it was alluded to that the United States, we're just simply not producing these students. And frankly, this is not a crowding out effect. And indeed, one doesn't really know what to do with this, but the last thing I'll say before I think that illustrates the centrality of immigration, for example, in biomedical research, where the United States is a leader. If you look at the graduates of elite private higher education in the United States over the last decade, depending on the definition, something like 40% of the graduates went into financial services. So it's not just that these fields are hard and there's long training, but there's a clear choice being made by the American-born students. And frankly, without immigration, our labs would be unstaffed and empty. And so we couldn't be innovators. We couldn't be the world-leading force, for example, in biomedical science without immigration. And one of the sad things that has already been alluded to is even among the most successful of these individuals, most of them are forced to leave.
So we have a situation now where we're exporting expertise that we could be advantageously keeping here in the country?
We are doing that, and the other thing we're doing is many, many American universities are collaborating, with Qatar, with the UAE. This is not an evaluative statement, or with Singapore, setting up hubs to develop excellence that ultimately, if you're being optimistic, will increase scientific progress in the world, which is good for everybody in the world. But if you're being a bit focused on American advantage, when Judge Lambert issued his injunction, now briefly overturned, on stem cells, Singapore basically said, come to us. We have no such, prohibitions. And so they're that
So the market adapts.
The market adapts, absolutely.
Interesting. Lydia Temez joins us, has come all the way from Seattle, so thank you for coming cross-country to join us. Lydia directs all of Microsoft's global immigration programs, certified in 1993 as a specialist in immigration and nationality law by the Texas Board of Legal Specialization. Temez guides senior management in formulating U.S. and global immigration policies and practices for the company. She also operationalized Volunteer Advocates for Immigrant Justice, a volunteer effort now in its fifth year, which represents asylum seekers and other immigrants, including unaccompanied children, held in immigration detention facilities in the Seattle area. As part of her responsibilities, Temez oversees Microsoft's pro bono participation in the program. Lydia, thank you for being here. I'm interested in the general question about how this impacts you, the technology sector, companies like Microsoft, but specifically, let me ask you, there's a widely held perception that visas for highly skilled workers are too easy to obtain and just allow employers to substitute low-wage foreign workers for higher-wage American workers. Is this myth a reality? And why do you need foreign professionals in the first place?
First of all, thank you for the opportunity to get to speak here today. How we address the issue of high-skilled immigration and these workforce issues will have a dramatic impact on who we are as a country in the future. You know, what kind of economic and intellectual strength we bring to bear, and how we compete globally, generally. Let me start with your last question of why do we need to hire foreign professionals in the first place? The answer is a simple one, but it's counterintuitive. We need to hire foreign professionals in order to, because it's good for our American workforce. And you may answer, well, why is that? You know, when I look at Microsoft, what makes Microsoft great is our extraordinary workforce. And we need to hire the best talent in the world in order to make the country great and to really add to that extraordinary workforce. We need to be able to grow our American jobs. Microsoft is a major creator of jobs up until in the 3 years before the current economic downturn, we had increased U.S. jobs by 40% just in that three-year period alone. And every year since the company was created 35 years ago, you know, the company has added jobs. The vast majority of the jobs in the U.S. are filled by U.S. workers. Microsoft would prefer to be able to hire even more U.S. workers, but as we've been speaking about today, there just are not enough American workers to fill the kinds of jobs that we need. As a company, Microsoft has invested very, very heavily in education, and particularly heavily in the education with regards to science, technology, engineering, and math. But our efforts so far haven't yielded fruit. It's a ship that's going to take many years for it to turn. We just are not getting the enough American students graduating from the institution. So Microsoft, along with other U.S. companies, universities, research, hospitals, we'll need to continue to look beyond our own shores in order to find the best talent available. I want to be clear, though, about our talent philosophy, and that is that even if we are able to turn the ship and start yielding, even more students graduating from our universities in engineering and science and technology and math, we're always going to need a small complement of foreign workers. Microsoft is great because it's a company that has great ideas from people from all over the world. I think that we should always strive to bring the best and the brightest, you know, to any task at hand. And it's really not a one-to-one equation. It's not a U.S. worker versus foreign worker equation. The more smart people that we have, the better a company that we are, and the better the country is. Is it easy to get a visa for a high-skilled professional? No, that's a myth. It's very difficult. If you look just at the green card process, if I want to sponsor somebody to become a permanent resident, to because we want to hire them permanently, it's a process that takes a decade very often to be able to sponsor somebody. The first step of the process is to sponsor somebody. Generally, we have to sponsor them for a labor certification, wherein we have to prove that there aren't enough American workers willing, qualified, and able to do the job that we're hiring that foreign worker for. That step alone is a two-year, generally a two-year process. And that's when the delay really begins, because once you're able to get through that step, then you're having to deal with the normal, the USCIS portion of the process. And the way the system is set up, the way Congress set up the system more than two decades ago, it's a system where there's an allotment of only 140,000 employment-based green cards available each year. That may seem like a lot, 140,000, employment-based green cards, but it's actually a very small number, because that 140,000 is for every category. It's everything from diplomats to outstanding researchers to investors to people that get sponsored through the labor certification process. And to top it off, that 140,000, it doesn't include family members. It within that is encompassed the family members. So if I am married and have two children, I use up four numbers of that 140,000. And then the process is even more complicated, because no country can get more than 7% of the green card numbers. So if I'm from Austria, I get the same percentage of numbers as somebody from China. So right now, if I am somebody with a getting sponsored and I have a master's and I'm from India, that process is 4.5 years. If I'm getting sponsored for a position that requires only a bachelor's degree, that's 7.5 years. So it really is a decade-long process to sponsor people. And it's not very difficult to connect the dots. When you have a process that's taking 10 years to go through, it becomes much more difficult to make coming to the U.S. competitive, for those numbers of students that are graduating each year. Whether they choose to remain here and use the education that they gain here, they're really two separate issues. Just because they're coming in and getting educated, that doesn't mean that they're going to remain here and continue to work for U.S. companies, because our process is not friendly. In fact, what we're hearing is we're losing, students at the front end, people not wanting to become students because they already know that it's going to be much, much more difficult for them to become green card holders, so that it really, there really isn't a long-term future for them in the U.S. So either they have to make a decision to just come and study and then leave, or, they're signing up for a decade-long process. But we're losing these individuals. We're losing them at the front end and at the back end.
Can you quantify that at all in terms of what that means for Microsoft, for example, in terms of people that you might be losing, or how the impact on the company?
In terms of the impact on the company, it's very highly competitive to get the best and bright talent up front. But in terms of what makes it difficult is there are other parts of the system that are broken as well. For example, you know, we're finding that we're losing a lot of our, even our current visa holders today, they're choosing to leave and return to their home countries or to other countries because their spouses can't work while they're in the U.S. So if you're here on an H-1B visa, your spouse can't work. And when you're looking at a process that's taking 10 years to go through, the fact that your spouse can't work for those 10 years is extremely difficult for that spouse. What we hear from our employees, and we stay very, very connected to our employees, is that this is the single most difficult issue for them, that the fact that their spouses can't work. You know, for those spouses, they're suffering from the normal human suffering that comes from losing their value. Most of those spouses are, in their own right, highly educated. They're doctors, they're engineers in their own right, and not being able to work for them brings along that depression and anxiety that comes from not being able to add value. But in terms of the household, it's creating a lot of issues for the visa workers. Even if they're earning a healthy salary working at Microsoft, you know, it's still difficult to buy a home in the Seattle area. Houses aren't cheap in the Seattle area, and you know, making those decisions to buy a home or you know, buy a second car, you know, those they become difficult life decisions. So, you know, I just heard from one employee whose spouse just did get they just got their green cards, and the spouse was now able to work, and she started up her own business and created 10 jobs for other Americans. We're losing the value of those other potential workers, and the value of people buying homes when the spouse work issue becomes so difficult, and when the green card process is a 10-year process.
Fascinating. That's a really interesting angle. To my left, both geographically and politically, is one of the most, the foremost union leaders in the country. And this is John Wilhelm, who has a long history in the labor movement. He's president of Unite Here. He has an established reputation as an innovative union leader. His career has been characterized by creative organizing and corporate strategies, a strong commitment to rank and file member participation, reaching out to workers across ethnic and language barriers, and building positive, mutually beneficial relationships with employers. He's negotiated many excellent collective bargaining agreements on behalf of union members and has a history of tenacity when conflicts have arisen with employers. So you are really on the front lines. This is where most of the debate really focuses. And can you give us an idea about the impact on your workers and mid and low-level workers across the country?
Well, I was really pleased to hear Bob Rubin in his introductory remarks talk about the importance of both high-skilled and low-skilled immigration. I think we make a big mistake when we split it up. In my own industry, the hospitality industry, we couldn't open the doors in the morning in the hotels and restaurants of America without continued immigration. That's always been true of the hospitality industry. Our union was founded in 1891 at a convention which had two African Americans, uncommon in unions of that day. We were proud of that. And 29 other delegates from the countries of the sources of immigration of that day, from different parts of Europe for the most part. It's always been the nature of our industry, but as one of the people in the earlier panel said, there are lots of things you couldn't do in America without continued immigration. Look at healthcare. Anybody been to a hospital lately? Who are the doctors? Who are the nurses? Who cleaned the floors? Anybody been, as the doctor said, into a biomed lab, which is the driving force of the economics of most major American universities and hospital teaching centers today? You literally couldn't open them up without immigrants. So I think we ought not, and you can go on down the line in most industries, I think we ought not chop this up into, well, let's try to get a little something extra for the high-skilled people. Let's try to get a little something extra for the agricultural people. We ought to tackle this as a nation. As a Democrat, I revel in the phenomenon that Mark was talking about earlier, the political phenomenon. As an American, I find it appalling and frightening. As a Democrat, I think it's great because, you know, somebody mentioned Prop 187 in California in the earlier panel. Well, if you look at California politics, California was a swing state, if not a Republican state, before that.
That's right.
The Republicans and Governor Wilson were the drivers of Prop 187. It passed. The courts nullified most of it. And what happened? California turned blue. And it turned blue substantially because of the awakening in the immigrant community in that state that Prop 187 caused. Now, you can think that's good or that's bad. As a Democrat, I think it's great. And I think that
Much for President Pete Wilson. Right?
Well, absolutely. I think the know-nothing elements in our political system today, the majority, though not all of which, are in Mark's party, and Mark isn't one of them, clearly. They're on the verge of accomplishing the same thing nationally. So as a Democrat, I'm thrilled. 10 years from now, if the know-nothings continue, Democrats will be in great shape. But as an American, I think it's appalling. And I don't really want to spend too much time in my own limited time on the economic case. I think that's been made very well. And by the way, I want to say to the Hamilton Project, not only am I appreciative of being here, I think that publication is superb. I plan to send it throughout the American labor movement because I think, you know, Bob Rubin said to me earlier that it's a debate, like many debates in our society, that goes on, at least in public, is fact-free. Well, I think that's a very good job there.
But we live in a post-fact era, right?
I guess so.
Adding some substance to the diet.
But I want to say something in addition to the economic case. And I think, from what I've heard today and from my own views, the economic case is clear. But I think there are two other things that need to be said. We are so ahistorical in this country. We are once again seeing, if we'll just open our eyes and turn off the television, we're once again seeing the revitalization of American life, ranging from big cities to small towns. I spent some time in eastern Iowa recently. And little towns and places like that are being revitalized once again, as has happened throughout our history, by new immigrants. You know, there's this great cartoon that shows a Native American standing on the shore and watching Columbus approach and saying, well, these people are illegals. What do you think we should do? You know, I mean, it is the story of America that we don't seem to remember, that we are perpetually revitalized, certainly economically in terms of our cities and towns, culturally. I mean, think about arts and letters in America and where it would be without immigrants. It's as bad as the economic situation would be without immigrants. So I think the case is certainly economic. I think it's far broader than that. Only three major American cities lost population between the 1990 census and the 2000 census, and in all three cases, it was because they had proportionally not very many immigrants as compared to other cities. And if you look at the boom in cities, it's not being driven by condo towers, particularly since you can't sell them now. It's being driven by immigrants, revitalizing those cities, which waves of immigrants did before them. I was at a funeral in a Catholic church in New Haven, Connecticut, a couple of weeks ago, and all the stained glass, beautiful Catholic church in a working class neighborhood, all the stained glass windows have been donated by Irish people, who were replaced by Italian people, who have now been replaced by Hispanic people. That's America. We all came from somewhere. So I think culturally, in addition economically, is an enormous case to be made here. And finally, I think there's an enormous national security case to be made here. After all, what is it that knit together the United States and Europe, in the particularly in World War II, in that whole era? It was the ties, I would argue, not between the elites and the bankers, although that helped, but it was the ties between ordinary people who had not only memories, but relatives in the European countries. That's what tied us together, I believe. So here we are in a much different world. Why is it we wouldn't let those Chinese graduate students in those labs stay here if they want to? Wouldn't that help us integrate with Asia a heck of a lot better than by trying to build taller and taller fences? And I think the same is true in Latin America. We have terrible national security problems festering in Central and South America. Well, the ties between the people who call themselves residents of the United States and the people of those countries are critically important. Remittances. The money that immigrants send back to their families in their home countries are economically very important in those countries, and those ties are incredibly important. We did a survey of our Haitian members in Florida in the wake of the terrible disaster there, the earthquake, and one of the things we tried to get at was what kind of aid did they think would be the most helpful. They were not enamored, and others have made this point, with many of the relief agencies and the government agencies. They thought the most important thing would be if they could earn a little more money so they could send more money back in remittances so their families back in Haiti could rebuild. Those kinds of ties, I think, are ultimately more important to our national security than taller fences and newfangled gadgets at airports. And then finally, I think that's the broader case. I think it's certainly economic. I think it's cultural. I think it's in terms of the revitalization of our cities and towns. And I think ultimately it's important for our security in this tiny world we suddenly live in. In my age, you can say suddenly. But I would just like to say one final thing. I think that the difficulties of straightening out our immigration policy have been overly complicated by people who don't want to face what I think is the simple reality. There's a failure of leadership here. Now, in the political world, you know, I remember John McCain when he used to be John McCain, and he was great on this issue. And Mark's 100% right. People like, and he left himself out, people like Mark, people like George W. Bush, people like Jeb Bush, people like Karl Rove, there are people in your party who get this, partly as a human proposition, but as a political proposition. You've all been drowned out for now, and I hope that's not permanent. The American half of me hopes it's not permanent. The Democrat half of me hopes it is permanent. The Democrats have become more timid, although on balance, Democrats are much better about this, including the president, than others. I said on balance. Now, if the political sector isn't going to do the leadership on this, well, why is not the business community? You know, a number of us in the labor community worked very hard. The labor movement in this country has a history of being nativist. Beginning about 10 years ago, a number of us worked hard to change that. And if you listen to the speeches today by Rich Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, on this issue, they are wonderful. He talks about inclusiveness. He talks about reforming our policies. He talks about the economic importance. He is great on this issue, as are most labor leaders. Where's the business community? The business community, understandably, and it is understandable, whether I agree with it or not, is exercised in the political sphere about taxes, about labor policy, about a whole bunch of other things. In 2007, that bill was not remotely perfect, but it would have been a step forward, a significant step forward, the immigration bill that failed in the Senate in 2007. The business community was drawing lines in the sand about, with Republicans especially, but also with moderate Democrats about taxes, about labor policy. Immigration, the business community just said, well, you know, it'd be pretty good if we fixed that. The academic community, the business community, and the labor community have got to provide the leadership on this issue. And if we all did it together, we'd blow through all this political nonsense, in my opinion, because it is nonsense. It's fed by this garbage on the 24/7 cable news, as is so much else. But that kind of misinformation and myth relies on division in the leadership of our society. And if the politicians are not going to lead on this, and they're not, at least in the near term, or at least the bulk of them, why are not unions, and we're ready, by the way, in the labor movement, we're ready to do this. So the business community and the academic community and other thought makers in this society, why aren't we all standing up together and saying, look, this has to change for the sake of America? This has to change. I think when you cut through all the complications and all that, and facts are great, which is why I like that book, this is a failure of leadership, in my view.
It's a great observation and a great idea. Let me just ask you a quick follow-up, which is the fundamental question and debate you hear out there all the time in the political arena, which is that these immigrants are taking away American jobs.
If we were to both magically and stupidly wave a wand and stop immigration to this society, jobs would disappear. You cannot, statistically, demographically, you cannot grow the American economy without continued immigration. And I would argue both at the higher skilled levels and at the lower skilled levels. You literally cannot, just look at the demographic facts. The native-born American population will shrink, is shrinking already, and will continue to over the next two decades. So how do you grow an economy in that circumstance? So I think the idea that immigrants and immigration is somehow taking jobs away from native-born Americans is a know-nothing argument. And I recognize a lot of people think that. But I think it's because, once again, the leadership of this country, broadly defined as I just did, hasn't stood up and talked about the facts. Where is the United States Chamber of Commerce? And that, you know, they say nice things about immigration reform, but where are they in terms of spending $100 million, as they're doing right now for other reasons? Why not, when the election is over, why not spend $100 million explaining the realities of our economy and immigration and the need for continued immigration and the fact that we're going to have more jobs if we have a reasonable flow of immigrants, and we're going to have no jobs if we don't? I mean, what happens? Now, we have members of our union who work at Harvard University. They serve the food. And there's members of other unions who clean the floors and do things like that. And there's members of other unions that represent the clerical employees at Harvard University. If it wasn't for what's going on in those biomed labs with all of those immigrants, sure, half the people I just mentioned, including half the people that are in my union that work at Harvard, wouldn't have jobs. Same thing at Yale. We represent 6,000 workers at Yale University. Half of them would be gone if those labs weren't doing what they're doing. So I get, especially in times of economic stress, and believe me, our industry is absolutely hammered. We have at least 25% of our members still laid off. You know, this notion, somebody announced the end of the recovery. Well, we missed it, believe me. So I don't mean to belittle at all the terrible fears of people who may never get a job again, depending on their age. But that's why we need to tell the facts, and we need to do it as a unified American leadership, rather than allowing it to be made into a partisan issue. It's not a partisan issue.
Well, it shouldn't be, that's for sure. And I will join you in calling on the chamber to spend $100 million on immigration after this election.
And I bet they'll listen to the two of us.
Dr. Hyman, can you pick up a little bit on what he was saying?
Yeah. So I guess the one thing I would add is that the $2 billion or so that the Boston area gets from the National Institutes of Health, based on competitive peer review, goes to buy, you know, equipment. It pays not only these workers, but it generates. We all universities do these analyses. Maybe we do them a little in our favor, but it clearly, this kind of innovation generates secondary employment by through patenting and licensing and biotech startups. And maybe the greatest example of that, of not biotech but of startups in recent history, is Silicon Valley. Sorry about that, in Palo Alto. And if you look at universities as hosts of foreign students, Harvard ranks first nationally with about 4,000, which is about 20% of our student body. Stanford ranks second, and you know, the home of Silicon Valley, and we know there are a lot of international people there. So there's a complex trade-off, as you said yourself. There's some people who feel that they're going to be unemployable for the remainder of their lives, but no case has been made that the kind of innovators that we're talking about and the secondary effects are what are crowding those people out of the labor market. And again, I know we've been talking about immigration across the board, what I'm in the business of doing, sure, we're looking at the high end. Here's another interesting, here's an interesting fact about immigration. And our absolutely unapologetic desire to have the very best people, and this is true, you know, Harvard, Yale, Berkeley, Stanford, all these universities that help make America great. Just unapologetically, we want the very best people because these are the people who are going to do the best job and be innovators. And for those of you who, you know, I hope everybody is well, but if you ever need a surgeon, You probably don't want the guy who got a C-plus in medical school or went to an unaccredited offshore medical school. Harvard Medical School has a 4% admittance rate, okay? 10 years ago, as a result of that, there were essentially zero foreign-born individuals enrolled in Harvard Medical School. And again, given the stream of talent that we are seeing from across the world, in 2010, 25% of the enrolled students at Harvard Medical School were foreign-born, and a very high percentage of the rest were first-generation, that is, the children of immigrants. Again, I just see in the kind of positions that create value, we really are a true meritocracy, looking for the greatest innovators, the best people, we just couldn't do without it.
And Mark, if I may just real quick add to that, Darrell West talked earlier about the shortage of American-born students who want to study science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Well, you can solve that in one generation or two at the most. Very simple. First, the children of immigrants who are coming into this country, particularly but not only from Asia, are going to study those things.
They are.
So the more that come, the more they'll study it. Secondly, if we let those graduate students who come here to go to school, you know, they won't all stay. I've had a lot of discussions with the Chinese graduate students and postdocs at Yale. And if they were allowed to stay, maybe a third to a half would stay, depending on how the government over there looks at it. But some proportion would stay, and their kids will study those same disciplines.
And to that point, you foresee that a continued reliance on immigration to keep our labs up to speed?
Absolutely. The trajectory, despite the very dramatic bump in the road for the financial services industry, we do not see a reapportionment of American-born talent back into biology or physics. They're still a very, very strong urge to go into financial services, and we remain highly dependent on immigration. Statistics are always better than anecdotes, but despite my day job as chief academic officer, I teach one upper-level neurobiology course every year, and I have to tell you that the makeup of the kids who are, you know, concentrating in the brain sciences at Harvard is very much skewed toward immigrants or first generation kids, the kids of immigrants. So I have a seminar this year, a little lazy, I teach a seminar instead of a lecture, with 15 kids, and 9 of those 15 kids either were born elsewhere or their parents were born elsewhere. And that's very, very different than the Harvard of 20 years ago. And these kids are fantastic, and we want them.
Lydia, is it really cheaper to hire foreign workers?
That's a myth to add to our list of myths. Both the work visa process, the H-1B, and the green card process are heavily regulated by Congress. And it's critical that to be sponsored for a work visa and in the green card process that you have to prove you're not, that the visa worker is earning the higher of the actual wage or the prevailing wage for that job. In addition, you would think that because this is heavily regulated, I mean, they're risk if you don't comply. Just this year, a company in Georgia was fined over $1 million. For wage compliance issues related to their H-1B problems. You would think that if it was cheaper to hire a foreign worker than it is to hire American workers, then the supply of the H-1B visas would get more quickly used up when the economy is bad, when it's in having trouble as it has been. In fact, the supply of the 65,000 H-1Bs is, in fact, still available right now. There are H-1B visas still available, which is counter to what you would think, that if it was cheaper to hire foreign workers, that you know people would be rushing to hire more H-1Bs. But in fact, there are H-1Bs that are still available. You see the same trend with regards to the intra-company transferee process. In 2008, 65,000 L-1 petitions were requested. In 2009, it got cut. There were 10,000 less that were requested, and it's projected to go even further down, another 10,000 from that. So in total, 20,000 down from 2008 in terms of the demand. So you see the same trend in both the work visa, the H-1B, and the intra-company transferee, that in fact, if it, that there is less demand for those visas, which is kind of counter to the idea that it would be cheaper to hire a foreign worker.
Let me ask a question for all the panelists, and then we'll probably go to Q&A. John, there's so many different pieces of proposals and legislation that are floating around. But in terms of your world, if you were running the show, what would be the most important priorities to get done?
Well, I think the 12 million that are here. I mean, I argued that there were several dimensions to why this issue is important. I left out, and don't want to leave out, the moral one. Maybe that's not fashionable these days, but we see in our membership and in the communities in which they live every day, families being ripped apart. You know, there's some kind of mythology that there's the documented people over here and the undocumented people over there. Immigrant communities don't work that way. They're intertwined, often in the same family. It's very common some people in a particular nuclear family, let alone an extended family, let alone a community, to be documented, others not to be documented. We see families ripped apart every day. The Obama administration, which has a position with respect to comprehensive immigration reform that I agree with and that the labor movement agrees with, nevertheless has deported more people by a long shot than the Bush administration or any previous administration.
Yeah,
and it's the human and moral toll is frightening. We see it every day in our membership. There is no political proof that I've seen, Mark, for the proposition, even though I think it must be the proposition that the administration is pursuing, that if you act really tough and deport piles of people and have all kinds of technology at the border and all that, that therefore anti-immigration people are going to be amenable to comprehensive reform. There's no demonstrable evidence to support that. So I think if I had my magic wand, which I seem to have lost or never had, I think we got to legalize the people that are here. Call it amnesty. I'm not shy about saying amnesty. I mean, we have a completely broken system. And then I think we've got to regularize to the extent we can. We've got to try to calibrate to the extent we can the inflow at various skill levels with what the market demands. The AFL-CIO has a proposal, which I happen to think is a very good one, to have a commission, perhaps analogous conceptually to the base closing commission, that would work with the stakeholders in the economy to try to figure out what that looks like in terms of future flow. I do think we got to be humble about that, though. Being Americans, we tend to think that everything is centered in the United States, but actually we're in the midst of the biggest movement of human beings in global history. And they don't all come to America, they're moving all over the globe. And there are a lot of reasons for that, which we don't have time to rehash, but as long as we're the richest country in the world, or even if we've become the second richest country in the world after a while, people are going to want to come here. And I think we have to be humble about our ability, politically and technologically, to effectively regulate future flow. I think we should try, and I think it should be market-based, and I think it should be insulated in the way that the base closing commission is from the immediacy of the political process. But we've got to do something about the people that are here. It is criminal. I believe that if we required every member of the House and the Senate to be chained to for a week, 24 hours a day, to people who are going through these issues in the immigrant communities, I think they'd all vote for amnesty next week, even the fringes.
Another good idea. Your magic wand.
Well, my magic wand, before we get to immigration, I mean, again, if an important focus is American competitiveness, generation of jobs, we can't separate a whole bunch of issues. We do have to improve our K-12, re-glamorize those areas like math and science, but also just fluent writing that are required to be important contributors in the modern global economy. But then just something that to me seems very straightforward is to be welcoming and to give proper long-term visa status, perhaps a green card, to anyone who graduates with a PhD degree in the United States. Again, you know, with all the right background checks, I think the point that was just made, that we assume that we're a magnet and people will jump through hoops of fire to stay here, is no longer true. Just another anecdote: I was visiting a new biotech park outside of Shanghai, in Pudong part of Shanghai, a year and a half ago, and four global multinational pharmaceuticals had set up. They are not contract chemistry or clinical trials, but actually fundamental research. And I ran into a guy I knew was a fantastic scientist who had been born in Shanghai. He was never going to go back because his kids live in the Boston area and they don't speak Chinese. I mean, they were never going back. But there he was because the opportunity was so extraordinary. We can't take it for granted that the world doesn't have the same strategies we have, and we really need to hold on to the very best talent.
That's a really interesting insight. Okay.
My magic wand. I think that I echo the concerns about the future flow. I think that we need to be sensitive to the fact that we'll always need to complement our U.S. workers with foreign workers in order to be competitive and competitive globally and always seek out the best and the brightest. So we need be able to make sure that we don't break the process even more, making it even more difficult to be able to complement your U.S. workers with foreign workers in the process of fixing the immigration system. We don't want to make it even more difficult to be able to attract people to work at our companies. I think that I want us to be sensitive to the ability to continue to create a path for permanent residency. I would probably be a little bit more generous than just the PhDs and say, we should be stapling to people that have that graduate with a master's or a PhD.
I wouldn't argue.
Or a master's or a PhD, perhaps a little more generous.
Do I hear a BA?
No. I'll be fine with an advanced degree. I think that both of those issues are critically important.
Terrific. So I know we have a lot of questions out there. I'd love to go to the floor, and we've got somebody with a microphone, do we? Okay. And if you could just state your name and perhaps just let us know if you represent any organization, that'd be great. Right here.
Judd Harriet, documentary filmmaker. Dealing with the current stock of undocumented immigrants is one thing, amnesty or whatever. But in future time periods, in future time periods, there will be an additional flow. What do we do to prevent that? What measures do we take to stop that? Any comments?
Let's start with John.
Well, look, as I said, I certainly agree that it would be unrealistic to pretend or act as though there isn't going to be future flow. There should be future flow. I think it's economically and other, and in other ways that I mentioned, beneficial. I personally think the notion of a independent, I think the word bipartisan doesn't work anymore because there's different partisans.
Transpartisan.
More than two partisans. But anyway, a panel that's somewhat insulated to try to figure out future flow based on facts is good. To me, it has a lot of appeal. I think there could be some rational study of issues like are being raised by Microsoft and by Harvard here, which are important issues. But I also, what I was trying to say by saying that we have to be humble about the future realities, it is the story of our country from its very founding that people have wanted to come here. And people are going to continue to want to come here. And I think we should do the best we can to control the flow of people and to rationalize it and to make it economically sensible. But I'm a skeptic. And I'm a skeptic that we can somehow shut down all immigration except that which we say we want, regardless of whose solutions you have. If you have comprehensive immigration reform or if you don't. If you have a fence on the rest of the border where there isn't one yet or you don't. I'm just a skeptic. I think the human nature is that people who are driven from where they are by famine or poverty or religious or political oppression or by disease are going to want to come here. I think we ought to try, but I also think we ought to be humble about the realities.
Yeah, I'm actually the left of John on this. I think we ought to just let everybody in under almost any circumstances. Hopefully there's some sort of biometric IDing sometime that we can do in the future. But I think we need to bring people in out of the shadows. People are going to get here if they want to be here. I think fences and other border security ideas are destined to fail. Anything you guys want to weigh in on this? Okay, next question. Here.
Yeah, Chia Chen, freelance correspondent, Bethesda, Maryland. I have heard that most returning Chinese students are working for American company. So to Dr. Hammond, does Harvard going to set up research lab in China and Ms.
Tammy,
I'm sorry. And does Microsoft have a research lab in China already?
Yes, we do.
And to Mr. Feynman, really American hotel are from Runner. American hotel set American hotel all over the world. Thank you.
So the issue of setting up labs and satellites is rather complicated. Our university has more collaborations in China, not only laboratory-based collaborations, but in the humanities and social sciences than any other university. In terms of any sort of fixed institutional collaborations, we do have led by Harvard Business School, because of the importance of what's happening in Shanghai, we do have a teaching and learning and exhibition space in Shanghai. Unlike a lot of other universities, we have the policy of not setting up fixed collaborations because we worry about long-term quality control. But many American universities are setting up international satellites for reasons, for mostly for legal and bureaucratic reasons, very little in China right now. Singapore is working very hard to attract elite American and British collaborators to help jumpstart their efforts in the sciences and are doing so very, very successfully. I think the situation in China is quite different, where there is an enormous and homegrown talent pool, and right now there's much more fluid collaboration than fixed laboratory satellites. But this goes to the issue of, you know, there are these huge talent pools in China, talent pools in India, that already where people speak English and elsewhere. And again, from the point of view of global human goods, spreading the productivity of that talent around the world is a wonderful thing. From the point of view of American competitiveness, we'd be fooling ourselves if we thought that if we are unwelcoming or different or keeping people out, that we will continue to be a magnet for global talent.
To answer the question, yes, Microsoft has both a research and development facility in China. You know, in terms of things that we need to do as a country, we need to be sure that we are able to continue to be sensitive to the need to make the visitor visa be one that allows us sometimes to be able to bring these visitors in to the U.S. To attend conferences and meetings. Sometimes we do have difficulty, even for our own employees that are in our China research and development facilities, to attend a conference that we might hold in Redmond worldwide when we're showcasing all the great wonderful research that's being done across all of our research and development facilities around the world. And so great work being done in China at our China research and development. And you know, sometimes we don't always get the chance to showcase it because of difficulties in sometimes the use of the visitor visa to attend your conferences and meetings.
Well, it is true that so-called American hotel companies, although I don't really think they're American, I think they're global entities. They are spreading throughout the world. Their particular growth areas right now are India and China. My union represents the people who work in the North American hotels. There are unions in China and other countries, and unfortunately, the American-based hotel companies are seeking to export their labor relations policies, which probably won't get them too far, particularly in China. But they're growing like a weed all over the world, no question about it.
We had a question right here.
I'm Shankar Vedantam with the Washington Post. I've been, the question directed to Mark and perhaps to John as well. I've been interviewing people in the Tea Party movement the last few days, and many of them tell me that Republicans such as yourself, Mark, and have sort of drawn the wrong lesson from Pete Wilson and Prop 187. So Governor Wilson was heading for defeat in the mid-1990s before Prop 187, and in 1994 he won in a landslide after Prop 187. If John McCain had stayed the old John McCain, he very likely would not be the Republican nominee for Senate in Arizona right now. And if Jan Brewer had been the old John McCain, she wouldn't be the Republican nominee for governor in Arizona right now. So the broad argument is that the GOP is never really going to be competitive among minorities. And pushing a liberal line on immigration sort of undermines the white base of the Republican Party and keeps white voters from coming to the polls. And the way to sort of bring those white voters to the polls and to be competitive in elections is, in fact, to have a hard line on immigration. How would you respond to that?
Well, I disagree with a lot of it, or maybe all of it. I think that it is a very short-term political strategy designed to play on people's fears to a very narrow base of voters. I think that more broadly, I just think that for a lot of reasons, that particular constituency of the Republican Party is getting a lot of attention these days due to recent primaries that we had, but I don't think it reflects the real opinion and attitudes of the broad middle of America. And let me just talk about the pure politics of it for a moment. When George Bush ran for president in 2000, I believe that he needed to get and got 40% of the Hispanic vote. In order to win in 2004, he had to increase that share to 44, which he did.
which was pretty remarkable, really. But a lot of it had to do with the policies that we're talking about here. John McCain, somebody may correct me on the number, but it was well below that number. I think it was as low as 27%.
Yes.
That right? So if that's the direction of the Republican Party with the growing Hispanic demographic in this country, then we're doomed to eternal minority status.
Can I have
please.
That too? Look, I know you were paraphrasing, but at the close of your question, you said that this person was suggesting that the Republican Party would be better off to stick to its white base. Well, I'd make three observations about that. One, that probably win them some elections right away. That's why I said, in my view, in the near term, the leadership to fix this immigration issue in the United States probably realistically isn't going to come from the political sector. It has to come from business and labor and academia, in my view. We've had a shifting definition of what constitutes white in the history of our country. In the worst anti-Italian periods in our country, Italians were not considered white by other people who did consider themselves white. But even by the definition you're saying this person espouses, sometime between 2030 and 2050, America will be a country in which a minority of the people are white. And if you look at there's an enormous demographic bulge moving toward voting age of people who are citizens. Now, I know there are people who want to appeal the constitutional amendment that says they're citizens, but it's too late for the bulge that's moving along right now. And so I think the course that you're describing, that this person wants to take, I go back to what I said before. As an American, I'm horrified. As a Democrat, I'm thrilled. That is political suicide. There are much smarter people in the Republican Party than that. Whether they'll prevail in that party, I don't know. I'm not smart enough to figure that one out. But that's political suicide. And if they want to go down that road, God love them. I think it's terrible for America. You know, after all, what is it that gave America the ability to have the American century in the last century? Our economy, our military, and our moral authority. And my own view is, if you took away the moral authority, the first two wouldn't have sufficed. I mean, that statue in the harbor in New York talks about you're tired, you're poor, and you're huddled masses. We used to believe in that. And the people around the world, whatever they thought of us, knew that. And they wanted a piece of it. Even if ideologically they thought America was bad for us, they wanted a piece of it. What signal are we sending out now? We're sending out a signal that we don't want any of you people, particularly if you're Muslim. But we don't want any of you people. That's what's coming across the cable TV now. I don't believe that's America. I think that's political suicide for those people.
Yeah. We got to wrap it up because our next speaker is here, but just to put a point on that, I think that strategy that you described for the Republican Party is a surefire way to claw its way to the bottom, both morally and politically. So, thank you all for joining.
Mark, it's really a delight to meet you. I'd love to get together sometime. Yeah,